started. She's really
the boss.
The boss. She is. Yeah. So, and we don't have enough people to vote on the minutes. So, to speed things along, if everybody's okay with it, we'll move to agenda item number 3. So, thank you everyone for being here on this beautiful spring sunny day.
We must really like it.
I know. And I know you do, Rick. So, you know, we are so grateful you're here. Because it's beautiful and everybody would probably rather be.
You know, Dave sent me a text just a few minutes ago saying that we shouldn't be playing golf.
Yeah.
Since we should all go.
Yeah. I think you came in your golf attire once, as I recall.
I did. I do have to say that.
Okay.
And I played this morning.
Yeah.
I went out and I played this morning. And of course, he said, no wonder that's from out here.
Oh, I
just put
on
this.
Well, hopefully we have to get out of here in time to maybe play 9 before the sun goes down.
Okay. I got it.
So Michelle is going to update us on the UI Trust Fund and tax rate.
So we're going to go ahead and go to the next slide. So I wanted to try something different. I know in our last meeting, there was a whole bunch of paper shuffling, and there were a lot of ideas or a lot of details that we were discussing. So for reference, we have this slide. Okay, so 2016 rates. These were for employers paying rates on their taxable wages. They were effective January 1st. We sent out notifications to the employers in December. And they actually won't see the change until they file their reports this month. During the month of April, they go in and report all of their wages and pay their unemployment contributions for that January to March period. So this is the first time they'll be able to see it. We discovered that employers are qualified for the minimum rate, so about 71% of our employers across the state experienced a third decrease in liability from 2015 to 2016. And then employers that did not qualify for the minimum rate are still expected to see about a 12.7% decrease. So it should be a good month, according to the board. Going forward and what we're projecting into 2017, we're still in the early stages. Nothing's going to be finalized with these projections until at least after June 30th, just because our trust fund is calculated based on a fiscal year. But we're projecting continuing health of the fund. And I want to take a few moments to just delve into what's called our reserve factor and our social cost. So if we go ahead and go to the next slide, let's talk. The demographic of our employers for the rates they're experiencing in 2016. So 73% have a minimum rate of 0.2%, and that works out to a maximum liability of $64.40 per employee. And then about a quarter of our employers are concerned with experience rating. And I think some of you on the council, you've been involved in discussions with the unemployment program and you're familiar with some of these details. Just wanted to take a moment to talk about why an employer would qualify for the minimum contribution rate. And really what it comes down to is based on their experience with unemployment. So an employer who hasn't experienced any layoffs in the last 4 years, an employer who may have discharged someone, however, we made the decision to deny benefits, which could have been if they were discharged for misconduct or for attendance issues or within their control, then we wouldn't allow benefits to an employer with experience any liability. The employers that qualify for the minimum rate may also have some employees that quit, but they quit in a situation that the employer wasn't contributing to. So if someone quits their job because they need to care for an ailing parent, we may end up allowing benefits considered if they're still able and available from other work, but we wouldn't necessarily hold the employer liable for that because it was out of the employer's control. So 73% of Utah employers qualifying for the minimum rate, it doesn't mean that they didn't experience any churn in their workforce, it just means they didn't have any unemployment insurance liability.
So do you know how we sort of stack up against other states as far as employees qualifying for minimum wage?
That's an excellent question. I don't know right offhand.
I'm sure we're better.
We're
better
than other states.
That would just be interesting to know what segment of our employer mm-hmm. population actually qualifies for the minimum rate compared to other states.
Absolutely. And I would add a qualifier to that, that the way that the rates are calculated varies state by state. And so some states may actually have employers with 0% liability, or they might have, which have their payroll calculated up. Yep. So it's not comparing apples to apples, but I can upload that information for you.
Well, we met with the group yesterday on rates, an individual representing a consortium of UConn employers, and I happened to look at one of the spreadsheets, and as Michelle said, there's different ways to calculate rates. You can have a low tax rate and a high wage base. You can have a low wage base and a high tax rate. There's lots of ways to adjust those numbers. So this individual was saying, look at these states that have such low rates. Well, tell me what the wage base is, okay? But the states I saw, for whatever it's worth, were higher than our minimum. They were like 2.7 was the average for the one state, which was a state on the East Coast, not the bottom. They launched like rockets into space. I can't remember the name of that state. But we can get the data for you, for sure.
Thank you, Mike. Mike Miller is my chief of contribution from the Hamilton Employers Finance for us. All right, so let's delve into the quarter of employers that have some sort of experience rating. These are the employers that are really impacted by our reserve factor. And so if we move on to the next slide. Getting a little technical, the way that we calculate our unemployment contribution rate, we look at what's called the benefit cost ratio. So we take that employer's unemployment liability experience for the last 4 years, we compare it to their taxable wages, and then we multiply that by the reserve factor and add on a social cost. So the benefit cost ratio is within the control of the employer. If they have a smaller workforce but high unemployment rates, they're going to have a higher ratio. If they have high unemployment rates but a significantly large employee base, then they may not have such a high ratio. It takes both of those things into consideration. For the reserve factor, it's based completely on the health and our trust fund. And I know one of the things we sent out to you before the meeting showed that, and I'll have that up here in just a few moments. When the trust fund is considered healthy, meaning that we're in this margin, that if we had another recession and we had to pay benefits anywhere from 18 to 24 months, if we're in that sweet spot, so to say, then our reserve factor is 1. So an employer's benefit ratio is going to be multiplied by the reserve factor, and they won't see any increase or decrease based on that. As the trust fund becomes less robust, we saw this particularly in 2010, 2011, the reserve factor went up to 1.45. So the employers had their benefit cost ratio times 1.45. So there was quite a significant increase in liability because our trust fund was declining so quickly based on the elevated benefits. What we are projecting for 2016, we're still at 1. We actually expect to go above the maximum level for our trust funds next year, and we're projecting a reserve factor of 0.9. So that means we would take the employer's unemployment liability compared to their taxable wages and give them kind of a 10% rate on that. And of course, that number is not solid. We're continuing to evaluate it. It'll be finalized in November, but we are expecting that the quarter of employers that have these benefit costs will see a decrease. And on top of that, they'll also see a decrease just because benefit levels are declining, so that benefit cost ratio number is going to go down. So that'll be good for them. And any questions on the reserve factor? We're in good shape. And our formula, of course, is statutorily defined. So how the reserve factor is set, how the benefit cost ratio is calculated, the fact that the benefit cost ratio goes to the fourth decimal point, these are all rules that are specified in the statute. And so I think this shows that the formula is working. To help your economy, to help your trust fund, the employers naturally see that decline in liability. So the next slide, going to talk about the social cost rate. And this is the rate, the minimum rate that applies to 73% of our employers. Social cost rate, the primary driver of how this is set is we look at benefit costs that can't be attributed to a particular employer. So going back to that scenario where an individual quits their job for family reasons and they otherwise meet our availability requirements to get benefits, if we're relieving the employer in charge because the employer didn't directly have control over it, then we have to take those benefits some way, and those benefits go into the social cost rate calculation. The social costs in their entirety, they range anywhere from $190 million to $442 million over a four-year period. So, of course, during the recession, we saw a large increase in benefits that couldn't be attributed to a particular employer. And the primary driver at that point was employers were going out of business. And when employers go out of business, we can't put them liable for those benefit costs. Another thing is employers were seeing such elevated levels of unemployment because they had to experience these layoffs that they were actually maxing out on their contribution rate. And so whatever they were liable for beyond that max amount was put into the social cost. So we're seeing that number is going down with the health of the economy. The idea is that based on the social cost rate, to change it from 0.002 to 0.001, or even to go up to 0.003, it would generally have to swing anywhere from $20 to $70 million each year to really have an impact on that. We're anticipating that from 2016, having a social cost rate of 0.2%, that that's actually going to maintain at 0.8% for 2017. So what that means on this little table here is 2016 are actual numbers. So 0.002 is the minimum rate. The taxable wage base is $32,200. So employees that earn more than $32,200, employers aren't paying any unemployment contributions on. But up to that point, they would pay the 0.2% rate. $64.40 is their maximum liability per employee for 2016. Our taxable wages, taxable wage base, is how much in wages we apply this minimum rate to. This is, of course, defined in statute. It's actually calculated on our workforce research and analysis team. It's 75% of the average fiscal wage across the state. And generally speaking, at least in the last 5 years, that taxable wage base has increased anywhere from 1.6 to 2.9% each year. So we're anticipating that from 2016 to 2017, that taxable wage base will again increase. Just to give you an idea of what that could do if the social costs remain the same, I just assume that we have a 3% increase. That's complete assumption just for comparative analysis. But if we keep the 0.2% social cost rate, we see a 3% increase in our taxable wages, then employers would see about $1 increase, $1 to $2 increase. And so, of course, these parameters are based on fiscal year data, so we'll know more as the year continues to progress and see how the economy goes. For all intents and purposes, and talking to some of our economists, the expectation, I know there's been a lot of flurry that we are due for another recession simply by nature of the number of years that have passed. Our expectation is that Utah itself is not planning on a recession. If anything's going to impact us, it's going to be coming from the national level. And those, of course, are things that we don't necessarily have much insight into. All right, any questions on reserve costs and social tax, reserve factor and social costs? We'll start with the heavy stuff, right? Okay, so this next slide is just showing us the blue lines that are on the chart. That's that minimum and maximum value. So when we're within those blue lines, that means we've got what's considered a healthy trust fund. When we get below those blue lines, we're running low. Our benefits going out the door are significantly higher than the money that we're collecting and that we have in reserve. And that's kind of, you see on the 2009-2010 time frame as that starts declining. And then going forward, the FAA will actually go above the blue line, above the maximum level. A couple things that we really relied on with this council for is anytime we have to propose legislative changes, we like to get feedback and buy-in and insight from the council to make sure that we're not operating in any government bubble. And so some things that the council has done over the years, you'll notice right before the recession hit in 2009, those blue lines are much closer together. And that was because we had defined that as being a buffer of 17 to 19 months of benefits. And just before the recession, we made the decision and passed legislation to increase that to the 18 to 24 months worth of benefits. The idea was that if we have a wider breadth of our minimum and maximum values, then we could help employers to experience less volatility if another recession hit. It would be a longer time for that right down below the minimum level. Of course, we did that right before the recession, and then this happened.
Because we're brilliant.
Thank you.
Great leadership, right?
Somebody get that on tape.
Thank you. And, you know, I'll use this as a talking point for years to come. Because of the statutory formula that we have, because of the management from our agency and the help of the council and the legislature and the governor, we were one of only 15 states that were able to retain solvency in our trust funds during the recession, which means that 35 other states had to borrow money from the federal government. I believe 7 states are still retaining that. So that was one change that we made with the council. A few other times is when that dotted red line went below the minimum value, and employers saw that reserve factor go up to a 1.45, so a huge increase in their liability from 1 year to the next. This council had recommended and the legislature passed that we put a cap on social costs. The reserve factor was going up, the social costs were also projected to go up, and this council said, let's try to give employers a little bit of a break, and so we capped the social costs. So thank you.
Can I ask you a question? How much of this did you know in advance, or was it just good timing? Or yeah, I mean, it sounds like wow, that was just in time.
So,
that was such a great idea.
So Jan, I love to engage in revisionist history all the time, but I think the reality is that as we talked about it in council, I think that we saw some difficult times on the horizon. So I think it was probably a bit of sort of looking ahead, and it was really good timing as well. It was just fortunate. Yeah.
A little bit of hindsight also helped me.
Yeah.
We understand what happened in 2004, and so we said somehow we have to cover that balance and not make the employer so obligated with what we had already set up. And yet again, we still wanted to make the trust fund be able to function and work as possible. So as you can see, we were quite a way down in 2004, and it really took effect in 2008 when we started making that change. When you do that thing widening up, it started to really widen up at that point there, where we kind of, with hindsight, had a little knowledge that it was going to happen, and then we did it. And so we kind of worked on it both ways to say, what can we do to prevent it from being such a deep cost that those departments were able to do so deep. Pretty frigid if we didn't do something.
Wasn't that the same time frame that the department was awarded like the best of the best 3 in the world for what you're doing? I'm serious. You guys are good at what you do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think the other thing that I would say as well about one of the benefits of the statutory formula is it sort of prevents us and the department and from making sort of knee-jerk reactions in difficult circumstances. It's, you know, you get into one of these spots and you want to make a really quick knee-jerk reaction. And quite frankly, the only way to make changes is through the legislative process, which is difficult, painful, and lengthy. And so it's prevented us from sort of, you know, jumping back and forth and back and forth.
The next one is just a visual representation. I just put in here to be interesting to look at. The green bars indicate the trust fund balance. The blue lines are benefits. And so you'll see that the blue lines and benefits and the red line being the amount of contributions that we're collecting from employers definitely operates countercyclically. We find that when benefits increase, that trust fund starts to decline. And then as benefits go down and our economy starts improving and as people start going back to work, that we start rebuilding that fund. And what we've seen in the last 1 to 2 years shows that continued increase in building up the fund. If there are no further questions, then we'll go ahead and move on from the trust fund. And I look forward to continuing to give you updates. I'll be taking this a goal to do in every meeting to show you the monitoring and to get your insight and to see if there are things that we might be missing that we should be considering in this monitoring. I'd like to go ahead and turn the floor over to Kathy Bonas. Kathy's going to sit at the table. Y'all are probably already familiar with Kathy. She is our Director of Education here at UWS. And he's also our legislative liaison.
Affairs director.
Liaison.
Slave. Whatever you want to call me, that's what I am.
She probably drew the short straw.
I think so. Right.
I used to cry on that day.
I think she enjoys it. She's good at it, but she's definitely glad that the session is over.
Yeah. So. Yeah,
I think she slept for about a week when it ended.
I did. I literally took a week off and went to bed.
Yes.
So, workforce services, I think there's about 20 bills that pass that touch us in some capacity, but I'm just going to pull the ones that I think would interest this council. The first one is HB 116, which Representative Green ran. And what this bill did was made it possible, originally what Green was trying to do was say that a franchisor is never an employee of a franchisee. Did I say that in the right order? And we had a problem with that because in UI we have two different factors we look at when determining whether someone has an employee relationship with an employer or if they're an independent contractor. And if they put that in statute, we would no longer have that ability to make that decision based on the facts of the employment relationship. And so we built into his bill the ability for us to still make that determination based on the direction and control that the franchisee puts over on the franchisor. So it still gives us that flexibility. It also put in there that if for purposes of determining whether two or more persons are considered joint employers, we can't, as a state, rely solely on an opinion from a federal executive agency. If that's going to reach broadly across all states, we need a court order or something in law or something in statute that delineates that for us as a state. So that's basically what that bill does. It's not a bad thing. It gives us that flexibility that we need. The next bill is SB 148. Senator Wyler ran this for us, actually. This is a bill that we pushed. What this bill did was bring our Workforce Innovation Act into compliance with the new Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act that passed in Congress. Made changes to the State Workforce Development Board. Well, one, changed the name of the board to the State Workforce Development Board. It mandated that over half of the members have to be business representatives from the state, added some other members onto the board. That was the biggest change there. As far as changes affecting UI, it changed on our records part of our code where it determines when we can release UI information and when we can't release UI information. It changed the name of WIA to WIOA, Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. So it was a big effect on UI. It was a name change. It did a couple other things. It took away the department's ability to waive a fingerprint requirement for a background check for child care providers. That's a new federal regulation. And then it made the lieutenant governor the chair of the Intergenerational Poverty Commission. So it did three things, which didn't all relate, but that was a bill we pushed. But that passed, thankfully. The next big bill that affects the department significantly is HB 325, which is the Office of Rehabilitation Services Amendment. And what this bill does is moves the Utah State Office of Rehabilitation to DWS. So they will now, that whole entity will now be a division of workforce services. And the predominant business they do is a vocational rehab, getting people employed that have struggles being employed. And so it kind of fits well with us, and we're excited for the opportunity to wrap our arms around it and help them operate in a more efficient manner and do what we can for them. SB 135 passed as well. This was Senator Harper's bill that affects our administrative law judges. And that's part of the division that I'm a director over, is our appeals unit. So, you know, when someone's denied UI benefits or an employer doesn't think it's right that they have to pay benefits to a former employee, they can appeal it to my shop, and we hold hearings with administrative law judges as the mediators. And what this bill does is requires that if we hire an ALJ, not just BWS, but any agency that has ALJs, that they have to use a hiring panel. And the hiring panel consists of the executive director of the Department of Human Resource Management, the executive director of the hiring agency, and then an executive director of another agency outside. I think Senator Harper's thought was he wants to remove any potential bias that may exist, even though there's no evidence that any exists. But we're willing to accommodate him and others and use this hiring panel. What the hiring panel does, reviews the applications, they choose the top three candidates, and then refer those three candidates to the executive director of the hiring agency. So for us, that'd be John Pierpont, and then we would get a decide from those top three. It also requires additional procedural fairness training for our ALJs on a three-year cycle, and the Department of Human Resources will be creating that training and providing that training for our ALJs. And then lastly, HB 337, by a Representative Peterson, is called the Worker Classification Coordinated Enforcement Act Sunset Amendment. Basically, all it does is remove the sunset portion of the Worker Classification Coordinated Enforcement Act, so it will not go away at July 2016, which it was slated to do. Any questions? Can I put you to sleep? Okay.
Only as when you passed the bill, when the bill passed SB 135, did it have a fiscal number? Is that necessary?
No.
It didn't have one?
Mm-mm.
The strictly volunteer people are going to do that.
For the ALJ?
SB 135, you said they're going to set up a committee of three that are going to make a decision on it.
No, they're just going to have to use their time. That's right.
Other duties that
he's right. They could also designate it to one of their staff to attend on their behalf as well. The bill does allow for that. But yeah, no fiscal note. Just, you know, work it into your day.
You think, Harper's kind of burr under his saddle about administrative law judges for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this sort of scratches the itch for him, or do you think that we're going to be back again?
No, that's my hope. Because last session, this is a result of a fight we had last session. I shouldn't say fight. A good hearty debate. Last session, he wanted to pull all of the ALJs out of the agency so they weren't employed with them and house them within the Division of Administrative Services. And I went and followed him and pushed back and, you know, told him all the negative ramifications for that. One of them mainly being that, you know, at the federal level, we're held accountable for how our administrative law judges perform. But if we are no longer their managers or have any control over them from a personnel level, we can't really direct them. We can't improve their performance. But again, we're held on the hook for their performance and could potentially be sanctioned for their lack of performance if that existed, but we would not be able to do anything about it. So that was his initial idea, was just pull them all out of agencies and put them in a central place. And so this was the compromise. He agreed during last session that, okay, he pulled the bill, and then we'd work on it over the interim and come up with something that was something workable for everyone, and so this was the result of that. So I'm really hopeful. He said it has satisfied that itch, and so it's a compromise. I think the only negative that we'll see from it if we do is if there's another great recession like what we've experienced just recently, it ties our hands and be able to hire as fast as we need to hire based on the increase in cases. So we have a certain amount of time in which we need to hear cases and then issue decisions. And so in order for us to be timely in when we have a surge of work, we needed to hurry and quickly hire ALJs. And what we did is we pulled a lot of, which was then Bill Stark's staff, but now Michelle's staff, we pulled a lot of their staff and trained them quickly on how to be ALJs so that we could satisfy that. So that's the only real hurdle I could see is if we had a huge increase in workload and how we'd handle that from a staffing level. But hopefully we don't have to deal with that. That's my big hope. But it was a good compromise. I'll take it.
Thank you.
We probably have a quorum now, so we can do a vote. Approval of, I think you all have the minutes from December 9th. If you could get a motion to approve them. Okay. Does anybody want to second that? Okay. So moved. So we will approve those minutes. Thank you so much. And move on to Michelle, who's going to get back to us on some other initiatives we've been talking about.
All right, thanks. So I wanted to start off with the CUBS modernization. And we discussed this in our last few meetings. CUBS is the Comprehensive Unemployment Benefit System. It's basically the computer software that we use to run our benefits program to make decisions of eligibility and issue payments. About 2012, we were currently operating with a vendor who told us they were going to increase the main annual maintenance cost by over 500%. So we kind of went to the table and said, do we continue and absorb this increase, or do we look at other solutions? And the decision was made to convert that software from its current environment to a .NET environment. The beauty of working in a .NET environment is that when you look at the computer program that my adjudicators are using to determine eligibility, and you look at the website that claimants are using to apply for benefits, it's the same code. So rather than having two different teams of developers, we can just have one team of developers. And rather than doing two different maintenance releases each time, we can just have one. So it really seems to streamline the process and kind of enhance our system. Of course, converting from one system to another is a larger deal. We made the decision around 2013 to do it module by module, rather than saying, as of this night, this was a split. So we've been doing module by module. We started in January of 2013. We had some additional funds that were awarded to us in 2010 called modernization funds. And this had been discussed with the council previously, where we modernized our rules on what wages were considered for unemployment benefit eligibility. Instead of just looking at the first four of the last five completed calendar quarters, we instituted an option to look at the four most recent completed quarters. So if someone doesn't have that original work history, then we'll look at their more recent wages to see if they will qualify for benefits. Because of that, the federal government gave us about $23 million in extra funds. Where we were at in 2010, we deposited those into trust funds. We knew benefit levels were increasing. That would give us at least $23 million buffer before we went insolvent. That wasn't the case. Now that we've gotten through the recession, we've been looking at ways that we can spend that money. It can either be used to pay benefits with no legislative action, or it can be appropriated by the Utah state legislature to use for unemployment modernization efforts. So 2015 general session, we asked for them to award us $2 million of those funds to help pay for this benefit system upgrade. We went back at this most recent session, we asked for another $1.6 million for this fiscal year, and then $4 million for fiscal year 2017. So we're moving along with this benefits upgrade. As of 3 weeks ago, we now have three of our six major units operating in the new .NET environment. We're definitely making progress. We expect to be finished with the module-by-module upgrade by June of 2018. It's interesting for some of my staff when they, up until 3 weeks ago, our adjudicators would get an issue regarding a potential overpayment. And the overpayment investigation team was operating in the new environment. So they would go to the original environment, they would click on a button. Because we're doing it module by module, the two systems talk to each other. So they could click on the button, they would pull up the case in the new environment, they would review that, and they go back to the old environment and post the decision. So a little difficult for staff, but we still thought that that was a much more measured approach than going to Big Bang. And so as of 3 weeks ago, we've been converting the adjudication team over to the new one, so they're fully operational in the new .NET environment. So it's exciting for us, and exciting for our staff. We've really made a point of involving them in the testing. All right. Next one, I want to give you an update on debt collection information. So this is the result of a bill that passed a few legislative sessions ago where if a debt collection agency gets a court order, they can submit that and pay a fee to us, and we'll provide them with information on the motion and center so that they can then use to pursue collection efforts against their private debt. We currently have 83 contracts that we sent out for an internal security review in December. And 47 of those contracts returned to internal security review. So this is basically a way of us protecting the confidentiality of our information. Before we would even enter into this agreement, they had to sign an MOU with us. And this internal security review that the 47 entities signed, they had to certify that the information received by this agency is only used to the extent necessary to assist for the purpose identified in the agreement. certify that only authorized agency employees have access to the information, and the information is stored securely such that unauthorized persons do not have access. And they also had to certify that agency employees with access to BWSS information understand and adhere to the disclosure and confidentiality requirements, and that is so 47 of those entities signed this form and returned it back to us. And so we'll continue to share the information with them, provided they provide the support order and they get a fee. Our anticipation is that we'll be doing the certification process on an annual basis. So this is kind of one way of us showing that you said that you would adhere to our security requirements, and now we're going to actually require you to evaluate that and certify it every year. In addition, and for those entities that didn't respond to our internal security reviews, we basically cut them off. So if they send us a court order, we'll say that they haven't entered into an agreement with us. They need to go through the appropriate steps before we'll share any further information. And then also, my business team are working to identify a vendor that can actually perform on-site audits. So we'll take those 47 entities. I'm not sure if we'll be able to get to all of them within a year. We may just choose the more high-profile ones that have the majority of the requests coming in. But we're looking at actually having auditors go out on site to these places and show and have them show us where they're keeping this information, how they're destroying it, how they're ensuring that only appropriate employees have access to it. So we're able to use the money that they pay in fees to pay for these audits.
What do we charge them? Whatever it is, it's not enough, but what do we charge them?
We charge them $15 per request, regardless of whether or not there's a match in our system.
How much time does it take staff and work on these requests?
So we did some programming probably about 2 years ago where the individual gives a request and the staff person will data enter the social security number of which enter information pulled in front of the green if it's a match, they print it, if it's not, then they just move on to the next one. It's actually a pretty quick process. Thus far, I think the staff time in my shop for processing the requests, and the staff time in Kathy's shop for reviewing the information security agreements, it's less than $10,000 a quarter.
Okay.
So the cost is 10 grand a quarter.
Less than, yeah.
And then what's the revenue per quarter?
So right here in 2006 or 2015 rather, we collected $162,000 in revenue. And then in the last 2 months we did over $20,000. So we'll use part of that to pay the staff time, and then the remainder is going to be used for doing the on-site audit. In information sharing with Department of Labor right now in prison. And so this is why Kathy would be making a small change to UI. Anytime we go with that information sharing, full transparency. So this bill was passed in the 2015 general session. And basically the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division is the federal agency responsible for enforcing the Federal Labor Standards Act. They came to us and requested access to our audit findings of the classified workers so that they could get and conduct their own investigation. The idea is that if an employer is not complying with unemployment insurance by misclassifying their workers as independent contractors, then it's likely that they're also not complying with the Fair Labor Standards Act when it comes to overtime and other regulations. So we went through quite a negotiation process with that to define exactly what the scope is of the information that we would share with the Department of Labor. The final compromise is that we would only share aggregate information. So when our bill body unit goes to an employer's place of business and says, show me your books, and they review all of that, they do a sample of the payroll history, and they come back and say, either you're in compliance with unemployment insurance coverage, or you're not in compliance. For those that are found not to be in compliance, then we give the employer, the law says that we'll give the employer about 90, we'll give them 90 days to cure that misclassification, meaning come into compliance with unemployment insurance coverage. And then if they don't comply within those 90 days, then we'll share the aggregate audit information with the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division. So we passed, so the statute is passed, it was effective, I want to say, May of 2015. We also put into administrative rules that more clearly define what it is to cure a misclassification from unemployment insurance services. And then the next step, because as of today, I have not shared any information with the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division, the next step that's still pending is to complete an MOU. Wage and Hour Division, they currently have agreements with 28 other states. And what it is, we've been working very closely with their regional office. They've been very receptive to asking questions and trying to hammer out the details. But then they have to take it to the national office. And for a couple of months, the national office had other work going on. And then the national office was concerned about what it meant to take curing of this classification. So because the MOU is a public document, and it is said that that we won't share the information if the employer cures the misclassification, they're concerned that it could be misconstrued, that the general public may not understand that we're saying cure a misclassification for unemployment insurance purposes, that we should be saying cure a misclassification for unemployment, for workers' comp, for the Fair Labor Standards Act, and much more broad. So we're working on a compromise in the wording. The thought is that rather than saying to cure a misclassification, we would just say for the underneath parameters that are defined in 35A-4-312 of the UCAP code. But if it's
this is why we have jobs.
we've definitely been in communication with them and trying to hash out the MOU. This has been a lengthy process. I just met with them in our department legal counsel last week. And I think we're coming from a common language. I would hope that can be finalized in the next couple of weeks. But as of today, I haven't shared any information with them. Because I was curious, after the law went into effect, Kathy mentioned the Workers' Classification Coordinated Enforcement Council. That's a council that includes Department of Workforce Services, the Utah Labor Commission, the Utah State Department of Commerce, the Utah State Tax Commission, and the Attorney General's Office. We meet every quarter, and we share tips and leads. So if someone's not complying with unemployment, then I will inform our Utah Labor Commission so they can follow up on that. The Utah State Tax Commission often gives us a big folder of here's the people that you should look at. And that was actually one of the questions that came up in the legislative session is if this is a, can't resolve this at a state level. And the response was that we are already doing active efforts to resolve it at a state level. This is just one more tool to look at. But looking at the information that we share with the Coordinated Enforcement Council, and giving employers the 90 days to cure the misclassification for unemployment purposes, I think we refer maybe 50 employers to the Classification Council. And if I were to have an active MOU in place right now with the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division, I would be able to share maybe 3 employers' aggregate information, just because the other 47 employers have come into compliance with. that when they're sitting down and having a conversation with an employer that you have these individuals that you're going to classify as independent contractors, they're doing a thorough job of explaining and vetting and really getting that, building that rapport with the employer rather than treating it like a gotcha program. So I try to support each other so I can find that relationship.
And key to what you said is you outlined all of those folks who are sharing the information, and they're all state agents. I think that the concern at the legislative level, I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but our legislature doesn't think much of the federal government. And the idea of sharing this data with a federal agency, I think there was some worry that we would open up Pandora's box.
And so I know I have promised the council before, and once the MOU is executed, I will share a copy of that with the council so that you can see it. All right, any questions on Department of Labor, Waste, and Organization? Okay. Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. And so this is something we talked about in previous meetings. There are basically three aspects of this national legislation that impact the unemployment insurance program. The federal legislation itself has a huge impact in how states coordinate their workforce development policies with both public and private partners. So we mentioned the state workforce development board. That's also comprised of employee and employer and public and university representatives. And they recently published a 162-page plan of the State of Utah's Workforce Development Plan over the next 4 years. That is available on our website.
So if you are bored or just like to read or, you know, you're a quick reader, go ahead and take a look and get feedback.
Absolutely. There is an executive summary if you're looking for a short version of it. And
it's
96
pages.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk
about
that.
There's also an economic analysis of the state of our economy in the first part of the report. So it goes through and it talks about the Salt Lake economy and the Washington County economy, and it goes into the more rural areas to show some of the strengths and weaknesses that they're dealing with in workforce development. So fascinating, but also an incredibly lengthy document.
And it was written by the board members. So, I mean, there were two chairs of that before, and so you know what a heavy lift that is for getting folks. But they were very engaged in this process. And it's
that's a good group. They're committed.
It is a good group, and it was a very collaborative process. It took quite a while. Michelle helped lead that with other folks from our agency, but yeah, it was a very collaborative process. Everything we've been doing with our state plan, and so very impressive that they can pull that together.
And what a great philosophy to say that if we're training the workforce for us today to fill the jobs of tomorrow, that we're talking to the employers to make sure that we're doing the right training.
It's an awful concept.
The breakthrough idea of the year.
So the three aspects of this legislation that impact unemployment. The first one, of course, is our focus on reemployment. That's our number one goal for individuals that are collecting benefits with us, is to provide temporary assistance while they look for another job. So we've been working closely with our local employment centers across the state. Shout out for a moment, Kim Auberger, who's sitting over there. She's my reemployment manager. She is running two pilots right now that focus on reemployment. One of them is to look at, right now we require that claimants provide 4 new job contacts each week. We're running a pilot to see what if we gave claimants the opportunity to write their own reemployment plan, rather than saying you have to check off these 4 boxes each week and report that to us. What if you propose what you need to do to get a job? And we'll give you a limited period of time to execute that plan, and then we'll see how effective that is compared to the other individuals. So we're running that pilot of 50 claimants, and we're in the process of analyzing the data right now.
And just maybe some context for that, why it's so fascinating to me, and I had the chance to, in New Mexico, when we were down there for a UA conference, this is like all of us. It's like, how people look for work has changed. And so I think unless you are kind of keying into that, you might think, well, are you, you know, loosening the requirements, and, you know, can probably speak to this the best, but it's really, you know, that context of how people look for work, how they network, whether it's LinkedIn or Facebook, or, you know, they go to orientations or, you know, other types of networking. And so we're evolving along with, you know, the way that people might network and look for jobs. So I think that's really kind of fascinating, is to see how that scraps up with the old way of just, you know, making contact the official way. Did I explain that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think one of the buzz topics right now is that you don't find employment from the people that you know personally. You find employment by connecting with the people that you know personally know. So if you live at 2 or 3 degrees removed, it's how you get those jobs. So the second pilot we're in the process of drafting up a contract with LinkedIn, where we would provide a select number of individuals with free access to the premium services on LinkedIn. So they would still be responsible for the normal workforce contacts, but we would also give them this additional tool where we are doing some evaluation of the outcome at the end of it and see how effective that is changing the back board. So as of right now, our current workforce policy is 4 contacts each week and report those details before you receive payments. We haven't changed that at all. We'll be looking at the data from these pilots to see if we should come back to the council in the future with some potential for those changes. So reemployment, the second piece is meaningful assistance. And we had talked about that in our previous meeting, where when an individual goes into employment and employment center, generally they're going to be referred online to apply for benefits through our website, where they can call into our claim center. And we just want to make sure that we're offering accessibility to that employment program, that we're not hindering anyone from filling out that application. So that, of course, is working closely with our local employment centers, making sure that our employment center staff have a direct link to our unemployment insurance staff. So if they're dealing with an escalated situation with a person right in front of them, they can connect and talk to an unemployment person either 2 seconds or less. And we do that through what's called a REQI help desk, providing that meaningful assistance. And then the third aspect of the element in fund is sharing of wage records. Another piece is for developing a state workforce development plan. We want to make sure that we be held accountable and show outcomes for that. And a large piece of outcomes from state workforce development is, did this person go back to work, and how do you know that? And of course, unemployment wage records is kind of come in to answer that question for them. So there's a lot of initiatives going on at the national level, at the interstate level, of how we can protect the security and the confidentiality of the unemployment wage records, and why employers report them to us for us to administer the unemployment program, and how we can also use it to enhance the conversation about workforce development. So a few meetings ago, we had sent out a survey to our employers asking for feedback on if we added things like how many hours did they work, or what was their occupational code, how amenable would you be to these additional elements. And our supervisor comments to come in and talk about the results on that survey. The individual that was pushing forward that survey from Louisiana actually recently retired, and so there hasn't been any new development on that. But I'll certainly keep the council updated as we go more. Okay.
Last agenda item?
Other department initiatives? So, Casey, you want to take this one? This is the veteran.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, as Michelle and I were kind of preparing for this meeting and talking about other department initiatives, I just thought you might be interested because it does have a touch point to unemployment. But we had a press release back in March, the 25th, that was done both jointly with our department and with the veterans, executive director, Jerry Carter. And this is really a kind of a labor of love for our executive director for the past 3 years. He's had a call to action to either lessen the unemployment rate for veterans, which would be equal to the standard rate for the mainstream population, or make it even lower, and we've achieved that. So this press release basically says we went from 4.9% in 2014 to 2.6% in 2015, and only 4 other states had a better unemployment rate for their veterans. So just really an amazing thing. With our veterans population, I think it was as high as 7.5% unemployment
which was higher than all of our other, you know, with our employment rate for all the Main Street population. So, I mean, that was just really discouraging for us. We just deploy a lot of initiatives with Gary Carter and his group. We have some of our staff calling veterans weekly, daily, in areas, talking to them, what their barriers were, why weren't they able to find employment. We had specific, what we call work success programs where they could come in, which were targeted for veterans, other job search activities, job fairs, those types of things. And our staff were really committed to this across the state. We do have a specific veterans program here, which is for disabled veterans, but we also, you know, included basically a list of unemployed veterans that we would get from Michelle's shop and send that out to our workforce development shop, and they were cold calling and kind of reaching out to those veterans. And I'm not saying they're responsible for all of this. I mean, you know, veterans did get jobs on their own, of course, but there were significant efforts taking across our state for all our staff for the last 3 years. So this was something we felt very proud about. We wanted to share with you because that's great. I mean, we don't want to see really any unemployment rate for them, but that's much better than it was. So we just thought we would share that with the council.
There's a great money ball there.
What's that?
Jerry's really committed.
Yes. Yes.
So what is our state unemployment rate right now?
3.5.
I know from the construction industry standpoint, the main time would probably agree that is our sustainable and large issue to the workforce. We cannot find a lot of people. If you give me 20 people to come to work tomorrow, you're talking to say, for 220 or 2,000
Are we working with you at all, Rich, on
I think so. Part of our challenge is we have 2.5% unemployment rate, and our industry has got some areas that may be a little higher risk, and there's, you know, at least in our members, you know, mandatory drug testing and a few other things. It sometimes is not as easy to get into as, and that's okay. We don't want it to be just anybody can come and get a job. But it's our number one priority right now, and we work a lot of our resources into it.
Well, if we can help anymore,
we'll certainly widen.
Certainly our workforce development specialists, that should be a priority for them. So if we can help, let's make sure that our staff can focus on that and mining those people.
You have many on the bench. Not many. You probably have a few, but not many.
50.
And the seed, like I said, the season has started. So.
Yeah, probably the same with operators, probably the same with carpenters. Probably the same, you know, we've never had more apprentices in our apprenticeship program than we do today. And it's not an amazing sales. So,
hey, it's a better place than we were 4 or 5 years ago.
It's a great problem to have.
And there is, I mean, you do reach full employment before you hit zero.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a certain segment that you will never serve. So.
What is that number? Are we there? 3.5, yeah. I mean, we got to be getting close.
3.5 might not be it, but it's pretty close. So in the last year and a half, we've been over as low as 2.3, and now we're pretty much at 3.5. It's pretty close to full employment. Nationally, we're about 5%, and 5.1, something like that. They think full employment nationally, if they haven't reached it yet, is somewhere around 4.5. So we're lower than that. At 3.5, the lowest we got in the bubble was about 2.8, 2.9. That's below a full employment rate.
That's almost scary.
Without people immigrating from outside the state into our job market, we really are tight, as you indicated in construction. and other areas of the economy as well. So 3-5 is pretty close.
Well, there's some big work coming. You know, if you just award the president, you got $2 billion at the airport. In my office in the last 3 days, I've had 5 different contractors that are proposing, and they're going to be bringing them in from out of town because they can't find the ground. And that means hotels, that means subsistence, that means a totally different wage scale. It's a little sketchy.
Well, before we adjourn, I wanted to take a moment to talk about our next meeting schedule. I think the council has expressed that scheduling in advance is often better than scheduling at the last minute. I know. So I'll put out a proposal, perhaps to finish off the 2016 year, considering a meeting the beginning of August and then again beginning of December. That will do us a couple times to meet before legislative session. And assure that every time I see you, I'm going to see you open meeting training. Kind of open that up for discussion.
Can we skip the first week
of September?
Yes.
August.
First week of August.
What about the 11th?
I'm good.
The 11th? Is it not going to be rich?
No, I'm working.
But right now, I'm working.
Are we showing right now, too?
Mm-hmm. So
John's calendar is smoking over there. He's trying to figure it out.
I think that lights are good.
Same time?
Oh, just about
1:30.
Would it be helpful if we tried to schedule for December as well right now?
Sure.
An uncomfortable thing, if the council feels the same way, if one of these meetings is coming up and we don't have anything on the agenda to discuss, I'd be happy to write an email update.
Pick up another job in Chavioma the next month, and that
can get a little sketchy and you don't have daycare and stuff like that.
But that applies to all dead animals, so.
So for a person, a woman at my age, which is 75 and 3/4, it's so wonderful to see all, see women in these great positions. So does the state, is there a very new state between them?
You know, I actually have a small study on that. Our human resource manager, so he doesn't work for our department. It's all localized, all state government, HR is localized in one division. But he did have some data on that, and I can ask if he can release that. We can share that with you.
Yeah,
According to the Public Tribune, we all know that
there might be a few other sources.
Over a 40-year period, there's a $626,000 in Utah.
And that's strictly women. That's not women of color.
That's just women.
Right. Yeah. Women of color is even further.
I will say our agency tends to have a pretty equal share of women and men in like across all of our positions. And it is something we pay attention to. Gender and pay and different, even ethnicity and race. So we've been looking at all of that and trying to make sure we're getting healthy organizations. So we feel good about it at our organization, but we had HR look at it across all the states to see where we stack up, and it looks pretty good. So if he can share that, I'd be happy.
Well, I don't
do
know. I just trust it.
We're looking at it, yeah. It's something important. It's something that's important to John, and we have looked at it. Yeah, so, and I think even now with bringing in the Office of Rehabilitation, we will have oversight of visually impaired, deaf and hard of hearing. We've got independent living centers as well as vocational rehabilitation that helps folks that have disabilities get employed. And so it's something that we are all, even more so now paying attention to is the broader context of employing persons, disabilities, and then looking and seeing how those three qualities shake up across our department as well. So I appreciate you bringing it up. We've been talking quite a bit about it, actually.
For me, as a father of three daughters, I'm excited
that you
asked
that question.
Yeah, we're
not going to get this over. For women in construction, if you think of women or girls as they grow, girls aren't told that they can do construction. So as you go along, as you continue to reach out to women in non-traditional work, and that's that with that woman's mission that we have for the legislators, is that that's a huge part of what they're doing. So it's important that we do recognize that women can do construction. And, it's very, very important that that is brought up, because not all women necessarily want to be a teacher, and not that that's a bad thing, I don't mean that, but...
We'll be sharing this
with you. Correct. Yeah. Your three daughters would be in construction, and we would
love to be.
So you are well.
Well, you didn't have to work for Rich.
There you go.
I have a story of Rich, and when he was over our workforce investment board, we had a scary situation happen at one of our buildings, and the first person to show up to offer support was Rich. And he toured that building and talked to those staff. We had a shooting. And he was there. He called us, and he was there. So I just have to say that. I think we should give him a little bit of credit. I've never forgotten that he showed up and was there to ask our staff if they were doing okay. So he's a good guy. I would let your daughters work for him.
Okay. So
Rich is a great guy. He's a great employer, too. So anyway, thank you for coming, and should we... A motion to adjourn? Okay,
great. Great point. Mm-hmm.
See ya.
Okay. Yeah. Not only for women
It was a list.